Chapter 8. I want to be a cub pilot, M-O-N-T-H-S. Afterward, the hope within me struggled to a reluctant death, and I found myself without an ambition. But I was ashamed to go home. I was in Cincinnati, and I set to work to map out a new career. I had been reading about the recent exploration of the River Amazon by an expedition sent out by our government. It was said that the expedition, owing to difficulties, had not thoroughly explored a part of the country lying about the headwaters, some 4,000 miles from the mouth of the river. It was only about 1,500 miles from Cincinnati to New Orleans, where I could doubtless get a ship. I had $30 left. I would go, and complete the exploration of the Amazon. This was all the thought I gave to the subject. I never was great in matters of detail. I packed my valise, and took passage on an ancient tub called the Paul Jones, apostrophe for New Orleans. For the sum of $16 I had the scarred and tarnished splendors of her main saloon principally to myself, for she was not a creature to attract the eye of wiser travelers. When we presently got underway and went poking down the broad Ohio, I became a new being and the subject of my own admiration. I was a traveler. A word never had tasted so good in my mouth before. I had an exultant sense of being bound for mysterious lands and distant climes which I never have felt in so uplifting a degree since. I was in such a glorified condition that all ignoble feelings departed out of me, and I was able to look down and pity the untraveled with a compassion that had hardly a trace of contempt in it. Still, when we stopped at villages and woodyards, I could not help lolling carelessly upon the railings of the boiler deck to enjoy the envy of the country boys on the bank. If they did not seem to discover me, I presently sneezed to attract their attention, or moved to a position where they could not help seeing me. And as soon as I knew they saw me, I gaped and stretched, and gave other signs of being mightily bored with traveling. I kept my hat off all the time, and stayed where the wind and the sun could strike me, because I wanted to get the bronzed and weather-beaten look of an old traveler. Before the second day was half gone, I experienced a joy which filled me with the purest gratitude. For I saw that the skin had begun to blister and peel off my face and neck. I wished that the boys and girls at home could see me now. We reached Louisville in time, at least the neighborhood of it. We stuck hard and fast on the rocks in the middle of the river and lay there 4 days. I was now beginning to feel a strong sense of being a part of the boat's family, a sort of infant son to the captain and younger brother to the officers. There is no estimating the pride I took in this grandeur or the affection that began to swell and grow in me for those people. I could not know how the lordly steamboatman scorns that sort of presumption in a mere landsman. I particularly longed to acquire the least trifle of notice from the big stormy mate, and I was on the alert for an opportunity to do him a service to that end. It came at last. The riotous powwow of setting a spar was going on down on the forecastle, and I went down there and stood around in the way, or mostly skipping out of it, till the mate suddenly roared a general order for somebody to bring him a capstan bar. I sprang to his side and said, "Tell me where it is, I'll fetch it." Apostrophe, apostrophe, if a rag picker had offered to do a diplomatic service for the Emperor of Russia, the monarch could not have been more astounded than the mate was. He even stopped swearing. He stood and stared down at me. It took him 10 seconds to scrape his disjointed remains together again. Then he said impressively, "Well, if this don't beat hell!" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and turned to his work with the air of a man who had been confronted with a problem too abstruse for solution. I crept away and courted solitude for the rest of the day. I did not go to dinner. I stayed away from supper until everybody else had finished. I did not feel so much like a member of the boat's family now as before. However, my spirits returned, in installments, as we pursued our way down the river. I was sorry I hated the mate so, because it was not in young human nature not to admire him. He was huge and muscular, his face was bearded and whiskered all over. He had a red woman and a blue woman tattooed on his right arm, one on each side of a blue anchor with a red rope to it, and in the matter of profanity he was sublime. When he was getting out cargo at a landing, I was always where I could see and hear. He felt all the majesty of his great position, and made the world feel it too. When he gave even the simplest order, he discharged it like a blast of lightning, and sent a long, reverberating peal of profanity thundering after it. I could not help contrasting the way in which the average landsman would give an order, with the mate's way of doing it. If the landsman should wish the gangplank moved a foot farther forward, he would probably say, "James, or William, one of you push that plank forward please," apostrophe but put the mate in his place, and he would roar out, "Here, now, start that gangplank forward. Lively, now. What are you about? Snatch it. Snatch it. There. There. Aft again. Aft again. Don't you hear me? Dash it to dash, are you going to sleep over it? Vast heaving, I tell you. Going to heave it clear astern? Where are you going with that barrel? Forward with it for I make you swallow it, you dash 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 split between a tired mud turtle and a crippled hearse horse." Apostrophe apostrophe, I wished I could talk like that. When the soreness of my adventure with the mate had somewhat worn off, I began timidly to make up to the humblest official connected with the boat, the night watchman. He snubbed my advances at first, but I presently ventured to offer him a new chalk pipe, and that softened him. So he allowed me to sit with him by the big bell on the hurricane deck, and in time he melted into conversation. He could not well have helped it, I hung with such homage on his words, and so plainly showed, that I felt honored by his notice. He told me the names of dim capes, and shadowy islands as we glided by them in the solemnity of the night, under the winking stars, and by got to talking about himself. He seemed over-sentimental for a man whose salary was $6 a week, or rather he might have seemed so to an older person than one. But I drank in his words hungrily, and with a faith that might have moved mountains, if it had been applied judiciously. What was it to me that he was soiled, and seedy and fragrant with gin? What was it to me that his grammar was bad, his construction worse, and his profanity so void of art that it was an element of weakness, rather than strength in his conversation? He was a wronged man, a man who had seen trouble, and that was enough for me. As he mellowed into his plaintive history, his tears dripped upon the lantern in his lap, and I cried too, from sympathy. He said he was the son of an English nobleman, either an earl or an alderman, he could not remember which, but believed was both. His father, the nobleman, loved him, but his mother hated him from the cradle. And so while he was still a little boy he was sent to one of them old, ancient colleges, he couldn't remember which, and by his father died, and his mother seized the property, and shook him as he phrased it. After his mother shook him, members of the nobility with whom he was acquainted used their influence, to get him the position of loblolly boy in a ship. Apostrophe and from that point my watchman threw off all trammels of date and locality, and branched out into a narrative that bristled all along with incredible adventures. A narrative that was so reeking with bloodshed, and so crammed with hairbreadth escapes, and the most engaging and unconscious personal villainies, that I sat speechless, enjoying, shuddering, wondering, worshipping. It was a sore blight to find out afterwards that he was a low, vulgar, ignorant, sentimental, half-witted humbug, an untraveled native of the wilds of Illinois, who had absorbed wildcat literature and appropriated its marvels, until in time he had woven odds and ends of the mess into this yarn, and then gone on telling it to fledglings like me, until he had come to believe it himself. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.